find out.
I will pound you like a nail, you scrawny little beaner.
Then do it. Unless you're scared.
I don't care.
Moose is a giant asshole.
I know.
But last year when he made your nose bleed, he had it coming.
No one has that coming.
Kenny, he beat you.
I know, Gwen. I was there, remember? I just don't want to talk about it.
Well, he was stupid to pick a fight with Robin Arianna. He's the toughest kid in school since the grabber got Pinball Vance Hopper.
I wish you wouldn't call him that.
Everyone called him Pinball Vance.
No, I mean...
I know who you mean, jerkface. Even the papers call him the grabber.
Just wish you wouldn't say his name.
You don't actually believe that story, do you?
No.
Because he can't hear you. He doesn't really take kids that safe.
I know that.
Finny.
I said I know.
Then say it.
No.
Are you chicken? I didn't mean it.
I know.
Hello, and welcome to the Brothers in Armchairs podcast. We are friends brought together through our years of military service who share a common interest in movies and pop culture. I'm your host, Kenny, and with me today is my brother, Dell.
Aloha.
And aloha to you, my friend. Well, it looks like we're going to get away from the anniversary shows this time, and we're going to dive into something a little more current.
Well, I mean, you know, every now and then these current movies have to be talked about. Sometimes we may not like them. Sometimes we like them. This is one of those that people probably didn't expect us to podcast about, but here we are.
I mean, this podcast has made it a habit to delve into lesser known horror movies.
Oh, so yeah. Like, you know, Black Friday. I mean, we've done a bunch of them, right? But I'm saying, like, look at our list of shows this year so far in 2022. We've hit some of the big movies, especially huge movies from the past. And so us doing these smaller films are kind of, you know, out of our rotation.
Yeah, this is definitely a quiet gem, I would say.
Absolutely agreed.
Today's show is a review and discussion of Scott Derrickson's coming-of-age horror thriller, The Black Phone. Spoilers today, we are going to talk about this movie in a way that might spoil certain surprises and information you might not want to hear about. But we are not going to give away key plot points, events, or the ending. So if you haven't seen it and don't want to know, hit the pause button, come back to us after you've watched it, or... if you're curious about the film, stick around, and maybe we can pique your interest through our discussion and breakdown.
I say go ahead and stick around. That's what I'm saying. In my biased opinion, of course.
Wait, we need to download, man. Please stick around.
Hey, folks, as a reminder, our goal on the podcast is to have an in-depth discussion on our feature film. At the end of the show, we will give it our very own unique 3P rating to let you know whether or not you should watch it and why. Our ratings are as follows. Play. This film is very entertaining and is a must watch. Pass. This film is not worth your time. And pause. This film is worth watching, but we have some reservations. If you want to see our traditional star ratings, check out our Letterboxd account linked in the podcast show notes.
Joe King is an American author better known by the pen name Joe Hill. He chose the pen name after not wanting to capitalize on his father's name, the legendary author Stephen King. Hill's first novel was a collection of short stories that was first published in October 2005 in the United Kingdom titled 20th Century Ghosts. This collection was later released in the United States in October of 2007. The collection was an instant success and won several awards, including the Bram Stoker Award for Best Fiction Collection and the British Fantasy Award for Best Collection and Short Story for the story Best New Horror. However, saddled right in the middle of this collection is the 30-page short story called The Black Phone. Originally published in the autumn 2004 edition of The Third Alternative, a quarterly published high-production magazine that features cutting-edge speculative fiction, The Black Phone tells the story of a child abduction by a man aptly called The Grabber. Trapped in a basement room, the boy's only hope lies in a mysterious disconnected black phone that hangs on the basement wall. When the phone rings, the child hears the whispers of the kidnapper's previous and now dead victims. Dell, I'm a huge fan of Hill's work. And like his father, his early work is a lot of fun. I particularly love the book Horns, which was later made into the 2013 movie of the same name. The movie, which starred Daniel Radcliffe in the lead role, did not do well in theaters, and many fans felt the movie was a pale comparison to the book. I don't share this opinion and love the movie as much as I did the book. And given that I typically gravitate toward horror stories of the supernatural and fantasy, it's no wonder why I fell in love with this author. Have you had a chance to read any of Hill's work?
So I did. And a lot of the reason why is because it's short stories, right? I kind of like short stories. They're quick, they're easy, and then I move on. Not only that, but the challenge in a short story, and The Black Phone is one of them, is to get you as a reader in as quick as possible. And so it's kind of like a bombardment of information in a very short span of time, which is kind of cool. But then it's hard to translate that into a screenplay, which is always going to be the challenge. So when you talked about Horns, I agree with you. I think the reason people didn't like Horns because he didn't like Radcliffe as the lead. That's why I think it didn't come off.
I agree with you. And I thought he did a tremendous job.
So did I.
Great actor. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, we did Guns Akimbo and people didn't give it a chance because it was Radcliffe. But man, what a movie. If you haven't seen it, check it out. Also Horns. If you haven't seen it, check it out.
This reminds me of when we were discussing our Conan episode and you were talking about the sword and sorcery genre, which is mostly featured in short story format. And something that you very much gravitated to as a kid. So it was fun to know that you still like it. You just read it in horror format with Joe Hill. So I kind of find that kind of cool, man.
Well, it was hard to avoid the Joe Hill conversation, right? One, you hear about this author that released these short stories that were just massively, massively praised. And then it started winning all these awards, including the Bram Stoker, which is a big deal in the horror genre. But then you find out that, he's the son of Stephen King. So there's some pedigree there. And he's not trying to use his dad's name. He's not trying to get out of his dad's shadow. But his work on its own is phenomenal.
Yeah, it is pretty awesome. And there's a part of me that kind of thinks, you know what? It is kind of neat that we're going to have a Stephen King-esque type writer.
Yes.
For a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like carry the torch forward, even though that's probably not his plan. But I'm sorry. If you're the son of the chef, then that's what you're doing, whether you like it or not. And in this case, he's a son of probably the all-time great horror fiction writer. And he's writing horror. So, you know, chip off the old block, I guess. But yeah, I like that thought, Kenny, that he's kind of carrying that torch because Stephen King is getting older. You're not going to have his works forever. And then this guy is of another generation. Actually, folks, if you haven't seen a picture of this guy, he looks exactly like his dad did when he was the same age.
Yeah, it's scary looking, right? You're like, did Stephen King clone himself? Like, what is
that? Yeah, no, exactly. If they made his profile picture a black and white, you'd think it was Stephen King.
Just give the man some cocaine. He'll churn out some big hits like Cujo.
Well, I think he still lives in Maine. I think Maine is the source. Like, that's the source of these films, these writings, right? I think that's where it comes from. Because a lot of the themes is isolation, right? It's always a loner or a misfit or something to that degree.
Agreed.
I used to live in Maine, Kenny. It's very, during the winter times, it gets very lonely.
I have never lived in Maine and I have no desire to, especially after watching some of the Stephen King movies. So I'm happy to let this one go.
That's right.
So with that being said, let's get into the film adapted Joe Hill short story, The Black Phone.
Before we get started, please hit the subscribe button, give us a review, and rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribing to our podcast just might give you the information you may need to survive a kidnapping.
You ain't gonna go like I did.
I've tried everything. Nothing's worked.
Yet.
Robin.
You remember what I told you?
That I needed to see Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Before that.
Someday I have to stand up for myself.
Someday is today, Finn. Today is the day you stop taking shit from anybody.
Not a fighter like you, Robin. You couldn't even take him.
You've always been a fighter, Finn. That's what we have in common. While we were friends, you were always afraid to throw a punch, but you always knew how to take one. And you always caught back up. Every time.
I'm not strong enough.
You have to be. You're getting out of here. If you can't do it for you, do it for me.
And now, on with the show.
I'll be home in the morning.
Where are you going?
I'm staying over at Susie's tonight.
What's new? The flyer.
The papers call him the grabber.
I wish you wouldn't call him that.
You don't actually believe that story, do you? Because he can't hear you, and he doesn't really take kids that safe.
You goof. Well, isn't that just peachy keen?
You need some help?
You see that? Yeah. Would you hand me my hat? Yes, sir. I am a part-time magician.
Are those black balloons in there?
Would you like to see a magic trick?
I have an announcement to make. One of our students, Finney Blake, was abducted.
What if I could help the police find Finney?
Doesn't work. Not since I was a kid.
I'll scream. I'll scratch your face.
This face?
Daddy, I had a dream about it.
What happened in your dream?
He was taken.
By a man with black balloons?
Yes.
We never released those details.
Hello?
Don't hang up.
Who are you?
You know all our names?
You're getting out of here.
Please let the dreams be real.
See the wall in front of you? I tore a long cable loose from down there. There's a combination lock on the inside of the storm door.
What's the combination?
I carved it in the wall.
Hang up the phone! Now!
The tree, the door, the gate? I'd never seen it before except in my dream.
You don't have much time.
You're gonna use a weapon. You raise the phone, step back, and swing.
Look what you made me do.
Please hurry!
You remember what I told you?
That someday I should stand up for myself.
Someday is today, Finn.
The Black Phone has a runtime of 1 hour and 43 minutes, is rated R, is of the horror and thriller genres, and is available for digital rental and purchase on multiple platforms. Produced by horror powerhouse Blumhouse Studios and distributed by Universal Pictures, this film originally debuted at Fantastic Fest in Austin, Texas on September 25th, 2021 to rave reviews. Its nationwide release was originally scheduled for January 28th, 2022, but was delayed to February 4th, because of COVID, and then delayed yet again, where it made its nationwide premiere on June 24th, 2022.
And I'll add that the reason it got bumped from February 4th and then it got pushed all the way to June 24th is because they showed it to a small test audience and they just absolutely loved it. So they thought, hey, let's try to release it in summer and see if we can't capitalize on the summer moviegoers.
Which I thought was kind of smart given the way this summer of movies has gone. It has not exactly been a powerhouse of movies. So
that's exactly what I was going to get to. Yeah. And I know you're getting into it later on, so I'll save it for that point. But very a good strategic plan, I would say.
Agreed. So made on a budget of $18 million, the film debuted at number 4, finishing behind Elvis, which was also opening in its first weekend. Top Gun Maverick, which was in its 5th weekend, and the Jurassic World Dominion movie, which was in its 3rd weekend, making a respectable $23.6 million in its opening weekend. The film's current worldwide box office gross sits at $148.9 million.
Wow.
Not bad for a low-budget horror film.
Yeah, heck yeah, I'd say that. What is that, $18 million, and they made 150 so far?
Yeah, I mean, they doubled their money in the first weekend.
That's a huge win for these guys. And I'm glad. I'm glad that the small budget guys can still create a solid movie that audiences will go to the theaters and spend $150 million on.
So, you know, Dell, while this film didn't break any records in its opening weekend, we got to do what we do. Let's see where we are with this year as we cover Dell's top 10 domestic opening weekend box office list. So, Dell, our list has changed drastically since the last time we checked in, and the following movies are now off the list. Morbius, Scream 5, The Lost City, and Jackass Forever.
Jackass is finally off the list. Wow.
Finally got axed.
Wow. It took a long time.
So, counting backwards from 10, we have the final installment of the Fantastic Beasts trilogy at $42 million. At number 9, the film adaptation of the video game franchise Uncharted with $44 million. And if you haven't listened to our breakdown of that movie, you should definitely check it out.
Yep.
The Jordan Peele sci-fi horror thriller Nope comes in at number 8 with $44.3 million.
Good showing.
Yep. At number 7, Jim Carrey returns as Dr. Robotnik in the Sonic the Hedgehog 2 movie, which I still have not watched, which grossed $72 million.
It's good, man. You should watch it. It's good.
At number 6, we have a record-breaking Illumination movie that scored big with families with the return of the Minions in The Minions Rise of Gru, which finished with $107 million.
So since we're not going to podcast about that movie, you told me to watch it. You said it was good. I didn't like it.
You didn't like it?
I didn't like it.
Oh my God, that movie was so funny. That movie had me rolling.
I don't know, man. There was something about it. It just didn't hit me like the last one did. I don't know.
The airplane scene alone just cracked me up, man. Peanut? Not a bag of peanuts, just a peanut.
they might be dipping too much into the well at this point for me.
I really enjoyed it. And I liked it way better than Lightyear. We talked about
Lightyear. Oh, Lightyear. We're not going to podcast about that. So yeah, I really liked Lightyear. I liked it a lot.
I didn't dislike it. I just didn't like it that much.
I can definitely see why folks didn't like it, because it really danced. Is this animation or is this live action? I don't quite understand what's going on here. It's not a Pixar film per se. I get it. And I feel they should have went live action. That's the way I feel.
I agree. I would have liked to have seen Chris Evans in the spacesuit.
Yeah, that would have been really cool.
So now we get into the top 5. Coming in at number 5, Dell's big movie of the year, Top Gun Maverick, $124 million.
Heck yeah.
And number 4, the dark and mysterious Matt Reeves, The Batman, at $134 million. At number 3, the fourth installment in the MCU Thor franchise, Thor Love and Thunder, comes in at $144 million.
At number 3. Wow. Okay. At number 3.
Yep. And at number 2, making a measly $1 million more than Thor at $145 million, are the dinos in Jurassic World Dominion, where they bring back the original cast.
Surprising. Very surprising.
And finally, our number 1 movie continues to reign supreme and has not moved. It is the MCU big movie, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, at $185 million.
At number 1. Who do you think is going to take the number 1 spot?
With what we got left in the year, I don't think anything's going to take it.
Neither do I. Damn it.
I mean, we got Wakanda Forever, so maybe.
Maybe. Timing is everything for that movie.
Yeah, but I honestly, looking at the remaining slate of movies we got to finish out the year, I don't think anything's going to surpass it. At least not for the opening weekend box office. I mean, let's be real. Top Gun crushed everything with terms of like total box office.
Yeah, that's right. All right. But you know what, folks? Hey, we'll keep up with this list whenever we get around to doing a theater movie again.
I like it. So, Dell, while this film didn't crack the top 10, it did earn double its money back opening weekend. And with its total domestic haul of almost $150 million before hitting VOD, The Black Phone is a legitimate hit. Everyone who has watched it and reviewed the film has been positive, and it currently sports a certified fresh Rotten Tomatoes score of 89% by only 243 critics. And it sports an 89% audience score with 2,500 plus audience ratings.
89% on both sides. I'm okay with that. I actually would have liked to see higher numbers on both scores.
Really? We've talked about this. Horror movies often don't do well.
I know. And I know I'm supposed to be jacked about 89% by critics, but
that's right.
I feel as movie structures go, this is a solid movie. And I think it deserves a higher rating by critics.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll get on Roger Ebert about that.
Let me call my guy.
Oh, that's right. Can we get Aaron on the phone?
He reviewed it. I haven't read it yet. I probably should read it.
I'm curious what he gave it.
Yeah.
So let's do some one-liners. Del, you got one?
I actually do have one. All right. So here's my one-liner. The Black Phone is a bone-chilling horror that brings suspense to a higher level with new ideas, a stellar cast, and a frightening villain in Ethan Hawke.
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right. I wasn't too confident with it, but I appreciate the notion.
No, I like the Ethan Hawke part at the end there. You're right. He was frightening.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I wrote a supernatural thriller with incredible acting that features a story about what it means to stand up to bullies and how we are stronger together to combat evil.
I like it. You went with the themes.
I went themes.
You went themes.
The themes this time.
So the poster with that tagline should be the five kids all or the seven kids all standing together. That would be the poster with the big mask in the back, right?
That would be badass.
Yeah.
Dude, you got to make that happen.
Yeah, I'll get right on that.
All right, here's a quick setup regarding the film. In 1978, a serial child abductor known as the Grabber was terrorizing the city of Denver. Her story focuses on the siblings Finney and Gwen Blake, who live in the area with their alcoholic, abusive, widowed father. We believe that their mother may have committed suicide several years back. Finney grapples with bullying at school, and life at home isn't much better. Both Finney and Gwen know the boys that have gone missing, and the legend of the Grabber has become a cautionary tale amongst the children. Gwen, who has been developing psychic abilities, is seeing the boys that get kidnapped in her dreams. As these dreams manifest, she shares her visions with the local police, who struggle to believe her claims. Yet she knows details not given to the public, such as the Grabber is known to drive a black van, and the detectives found black balloons at one of the crime scenes. When Finney gets kidnapped by the Grabber, he is forced into a soundproof basement where his only items are a dirty mattress and a black rotary phone that sits on the wall disconnected. The Grabber is an older male who hides his identity behind a horrifying mask that displays the emotions of joy, despair, and nothingness depending on the mood. While what he wants from Finney is unclear, what is clear is that Finney is trapped. One day, the black phone mysteriously rings, and when Finney answers, it's the voice of a child the Grabber had previously abducted. As these children talk to Finney, they give him help on how to possibly escape his captor. Meanwhile, Gwen pushes her abilities to try and use her visions to find Finney and relay that information to the police. Every day she rides out into Denver at night to try and locate her brother. Will Gwen find Finney before it's too late? Or will the Grabber's nefarious plot spell certain doom for Finney? For Finney, his only lifeline is the mysterious rings and those that answer on the other end of the black phone. All right, well, let's get into the making of this movie and the writer and director, Scott Derrickson. Following the success of 2016's Doctor Strange, director Scott Derrickson immediately started to work on the sequel, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. During this period, Derrickson and frequent collaborator C. Robert Cargill decided to adapt Joe Hill's short story, The Black Phone, into a feature film. Derrickson, who first read Joe Hill's short story in 2007, was enamored with Hill's ability to combine a serial killer tale with that of a ghost story. However, due to commitments with Marvel, Cargill agreed to postpone the project until after Derrickson's commitments were complete. As fate would have it, Marvel and Derrickson would have a falling out due to creative differences. In January 2020, Derrickson came on board to helm the Black Phone for Blumhouse Productions and Universal Pictures. So how does one take a 30-page short story and turn it into a full-length feature film? Well, it turns out that Derrickson leaned into his own middle school experience growing up in the 1970s in Denver, Colorado. The film incorporates many items from Derrickson's memory of that period, including the overcast skies, chain link fences, and the violence that existed for him inside and outside the home. As the youngest of 13 boys that lived on his block, Derrickson recalls his childhood was filled with frequent violence and bullying. Black Phone deals with childhood trauma, but also focuses on kids' resiliency. Unlike E.T., which helped director Steven Spielberg work through his parents' divorce in a cuddly way, Derrickson's childhood reckoning is far more violent. He forces the Black Phone's hero, 13-year-old Finney, to literally fight for his life by turning a disconnected phone into a weapon. Derrickson also ensured he didn't lean into nostalgia, as he felt that any urge to fetishize the era would be death to his story. When the Black Phone script was complete, Derrickson officially announced the project on October 2020. Filming took place in Wilmington, North Carolina, which is probably why a lot of this movie looked familiar to me. Principal photography began on February 9th and wrapped on March 27th of 2021. Little more than 30 days, which I thought was kind of interesting that he filmed that fast.
Yeah, no kidding. Especially it's a period piece, so yeah.
And to rub salt in the wound, fans got their first look at the Black Phone on August 25th, 2021 at Cinecon in Las Vegas. Geez. Del, this feels real bad, man. We were supposed to be there. We were so close.
So here's how it's going to work, Kenny. We didn't go. And you know, legitimately, there were reasons why we didn't go, right? I get that. But you watch. When we do go, it's not going to be all these fantastic movies, Top Gun, Dune, and all this stuff. We're not going to get any of that stuff.
Peter Rabbit 4, The Search for More Carrots.
Paddington Bear Returns. That's what we're going to get. Oh, such an epic Cinecon.
We'll get Keanu Reeves, but it won't be Keanu Reeves for a John Wick movie. It'll be Keanu Reeves as Batman in the new DC Super Pets Volume 3
that's right,
or something.
That's right. Anybody who was there, we are jealous. We are jealous.
But Del, man, what do you think about Derrickson taking his own childhood experiences and making them into a full feature film with Joe Hill's short story?
Well, a lot of times, so this is like, you know, you mentioned Jurassic Park Dominion is on that list. And, you know, you got to remember how they put those dinosaurs together, right? They had to insert other animals' DNA to complete the dinosaur DNA. And that's essentially what this did, because you got to take that short story and stretch it into a full-blown script or screenplay. So you have to insert things. And if you insert things that are just complete fabrications, things off the top of your head, that's a dangerous situation. But if you take real experiences, things that you know, you feel for, right? These are emotional connections. And you insert that into that script, it comes off in the film. And that's what happened here.
Yeah, it gives it a sense of authenticity to go
there
with
you go. Perfect.
Supernatural fantasy about it, right? Like, hey, we're going to give you a supernatural fantasy movie, but it's grounded in reality. And this is why.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a, authenticity. There it is. And, you know, could it be done other ways? I'm sure it could have, but we want to have a connection with these characters, and what better connection than pain and struggle?
Yeah, I can agree with that. I tell you one thing I thought was interesting about the movie, especially being set in Denver, was that I kept thinking to myself, this looks like a small town, but Denver's a big city. And even in the 70s, huge. It was a big city.
Yeah, but I don't know if you've been to Denver, but Denver so it's a big city, but the outlying areas, just like Los Angeles, there's a lot of suburb areas. There's a lot of townships and whatnot, but it's pretty expansive.
Yeah. I found it like when she's out riding, when Gwen is out riding her bike at night and she's looking for Finney or whatever, I kept thinking to myself, like, this is a small town, man. You should be able to find the house. But then it dawns on me like, no, this is Denver, man. This is a big city. She's not going to find anything.
Yeah. So they give us that little lead in, right? Like, you know, the cops are searching within their township, which kind of tells us she's not going to go riding 17 miles out of town, right? She can ride around town, but town itself might take a little while, especially for a kid on a bike.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Oh, such an interesting thought process I had while watching this movie, because I kept thinking, this is a small town. It's not a small town. That's why a black van can make the motions moving around town, because it's a huge city.
Yeah, but this is the trick. This is the trick about photography, right? Because you want to present to the viewer a cohesive story and scene and setting. So remember we did Clean with Adrian Brody, right?
Yep.
And we had questions about this town that he lived in. Well, it's the same thing here, but the trick is, do we need to know more about this town? And that's where the writing comes into play. That's where photography comes into play. If we don't need to know what more this town has, and we just accept the things that we see on the screen, then they've done a fantastic job. Steven Spielberg is probably the master at doing that. And I think they did a hell of a job with this story.
Oh, good point. Way to work in the Steven Spielbergness of it all, too.
Yeah.
Good point.
Also, do you think, like, how much do you think this movie was there for Derrickson?
So the more I read about Derrickson, the more I understood that while he was filming this movie, he was heavy into therapy. So he had been about 3 years into hardcore therapy by the time he was making this movie. And I think that this was definitely therapeutic for him to get this on. So, yeah, I think a lot of it was therapy for him to get it off his chest.
Interesting. I could imagine that because, you know, he comes off of Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness for creative differences, they say, right? I kind of think based on when I watched this movie and then when we started doing the research, I kind of think he wanted to be on this movie anyway.
There's a part of me that thought that too. Like, he was like, I would rather be doing that. But then you also got to kind of look at the fact that, you know, now that we know more about why he came off the movie Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, they really did have different views about where they wanted to take that movie. And where Derrickson wanted to take it was to keep it very basically horror-based and very... Yeah,
a little darker, probably.
Very dark. And where Marvel wanted it to be was, hey, we can be a little dark, but we still want these kids to watch this movie.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't care if kids watch my movie or not. I'm making this thing the way I want to make it. And so you can kind of see the creative differences. So I agree with you to a point that he probably would have preferred to do Black Phone from the get-go, but I still think he was putting his best foot forward in making the Multiverse of Madness.
Yeah, I would agree. He's not going to sandbag a huge $200 million movie. But, you know, I kind of want to see his version of Doctor Strange. You know how I feel about the silliness that Marvel has gotten into. Even though I know I'm not the target audience, I miss the original Phase 1 lineup of films where they were more on the serious side. And even though the Doctor Strange was a little lighter on the horror, it was still there because my little nephew got a little scared at parts. So if Derrickson had a hold of it, my little nephew might have needed to leave the theater with me.
But then Dell would have respected that movie more.
Hey. I still respect the movie for what it is. But it's a one-time watch for me, and that's the huge difference. I've already watched Black Phone 3 times.
Yeah, I've watched it quite a bit myself. Way more than 3 times. I might have had a Yo-Ho-Ho copy for a while there where I watched a dude holding the camera because I really liked it. I saw this movie twice in the theater.
I was going to say, you saw it in the theater. I saw it in the theater opening weekend.
Yeah, I saw it opening weekend and I saw it the following weekend. So I saw it two weekends in a row.
So opening weekend, you went to the theater. Was it crowded?
Yes. I took my son with me because he was, you know, this is one of those movies where he was like, it was cool enough to go with dad to go see. And so the two of us saw it opening weekend and we were in a jam-packed theater and we had the XD theater, which is like the big screen and everything.
Oh, wow. Nice. That would have been really cool. I would have liked to see this in theaters.
Yeah. So I will tell you that, man, like this Scott Derrickson guy, he's rapidly becoming one of my favorite directors. After I watched this movie, I went back and watched Sinister and I watched Doctor Strange again. And the dude is solid, man. He makes a solid movie. I really, really can't wait to see what else this guy's going to do.
And look at the 3 movies that you just talked about, right? So Sinister was his last collab with Ethan Hawke, right? And then the other movie. So I was read, he did another horror movie with Ethan Hawke, Sinister. But Sinister is a very unique horror movie.
Yes. And it's one of those movies that I would tell you I would not have normally sought out.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I went and watched it specifically because of Derrickson, and I was not disappointed. I was very, very surprised by how good that movie was.
And I agree. It is a fantastic film overall. Again, fantastic film overall, not just because it's, you know, fantastic for a horror movie. But yeah, I think the magic duo here, the screenwriting duo of Cargill and Derrickson with Derrickson at the helm is the way to go.
I agree. All right, Dell, let's talk about some acting. All right, first up is Mason Timms as Finney. Timms said his audition took place over Zoom soon after the pandemic began.
Oh, really?
And he said, the audition was quite weird and we had bad Wi-Fi. I'd say a line and it would take a few seconds for them to say something back. It got a bit awkward. But eventually, I did get a callback. So Timms was announced as the star of The Black Phone when the film was announced in October of 2020. An actor of 8 credits, he is best known for the TV series For All Mankind on Apple TV Plus. Dell, I have not watched that show.
It is an excellent series. You should watch it.
I have no idea if it's good or not.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I've kept up with it.
He currently has 3 credits in production, including 2022's Boys of Summer, scheduled to debut later this year. Del Boyce's Summer sounds pretty interesting and co-stars Mel Gibson. The film's premise? When his best friend mysteriously vanishes, a local boy suspects that a supernatural entity may be hunting down the kids of Martha's Vineyard. With the help of an aging detective, they discover a path to a recently retired witch on the island.
That dangerously sounds close to a comedy. This is like just a little bit.
Yeah, it could go either way, right? Is this Hocus Pocus or a serious movie, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, there used to be a time where if the film had Mel Gibson, then I knew it was just going to be a great movie, right? But Mel is doing the Bruce Willis thing. He's just getting into all kinds of projects. So I don't know if this project, Boys of Summer, is a project that he needs to do to get to the movie he's trying to get to, or if this is the movie he was trying to get to.
Yeah, he definitely seems to have gone a different way of self-funding himself. Night Shyamalan makes hit movies and then funds his next hit movie with the last hit movie he had.
Right.
Mel's like, let me make a bunch of crap and then take whatever salary they gave me and put it into the next movie I want to make.
Right. Now, at least we know that Timms is a talented actor, and I hope for bigger things for the guy. So hopefully in this movie, it's one of those deals where Gibson is in the movie, but he's not necessarily the big star.
So it sounds interesting to me, and I like movies that focus on, I guess, kids is the best way to describe it, because it takes me back to my childhood, and everything goes back to 80s. Goonies. It goes back to Goonies for me every time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm kind of hoping that this movie lands, and I'm looking forward to watching it, but based on the premise, it'll probably hit VOD at some point, I guess. So Timms is currently 15. He has all the looks of a future star. His classic boyish good looks and charms should serve him well as he ages up. He does a tremendous job in this movie of often chewing up the scenery for the sake of being the only one on screen. He's compelling as he makes the most of his surroundings, often having to look busy, in an effort to convey the futility of his situation. His breakdown when he can't break through the freezer is probably one of the most gut-wrenching scenes in the movie. Yeah. So Finney, the character himself, is a 13-year-old kid that has an incredible bond with his younger sister, Gwen. Often ruled by fear, Finney is often having to outlast the bullies that frequently like to pick on him.
Yeah, so the actor, Timms, right? He has a very non-expressive look. And so his character, Finney, although he's running through the gambit of emotions, right? The joy, the pain, the anger, the suffering, the defeat. I mean, he goes through all of those emotions. I can't honestly say that it's a total sell for me at this point. There's something about the way he looks that it doesn't translate well. There's always like this seriousness to his look, like the time where he's staring at his father after getting into that scuffle. So I'm not sure about that. I didn't really feel overwhelmed by the range of emotions that he was going into. But I do like him as an actor. I think he's compelling in the role. And I think that eventually he's going to be a young adult and it's, you know, sky's the limit.
Yeah, we often talk about these kid actors when we refer to Stranger Things, right? And so the one kid that often gets brought up a lot is this Finn Wolfhard kid, right? Which Hollywood is...
The Ghostbusters kid.
Yeah, Hollywood's kind of jamming him down our throat. They're like, this kid is awesome. You want to watch this kid. And I agree. I like Finn Wolfhard. He's a good actor. I don't necessarily know if his looks are going to favor him as he ages up. But this kid, Timms, seems to be a nice compromise in the middle there. Maybe not the same acting ability that Finn Wolfhard has, but definitely has the looks. He sort of reminds me of a young Jake Gyllenhaal. Remember when we saw him in City Slickers when he was
the That's actually kid. A good point. I like that.
And he reminds me of that when I saw him in this movie.
Yeah, I like that. And you do make a great point that he is the screen time, right?
Yeah. I mean, he has to, he's got to entertain me, you know what I mean? Like do something, you know?
Yeah. And that alone, that he can have all the screen time and I be stuck to the screen the whole time watching the movie. That says a lot about the talent of this kid.
Agreed. Great point, by the way.
Yeah. Kind of like Hanks in Castaway, right? We can't. You know, there's a whole.
Oh my God, that is such a great pull.
Yeah, it's like an hour and 20 minutes of Hanks on an island with no score, at all. Him and a volleyball. That's all.
The only thing different from the volleyball is he's got the phone. it's the only thing different.
That's right. I know people. He doesn't put a little face on the phone.
That would be hilarious if he did.
That's right.
I mean, I wonder how many people watched this movie and saw that phone and thought to myself, "What is that?" that's not a phone.
Yeah, it's not a phone. Rotary, that's right.
He's got that rotary that's thing. Right.
What is that thing? So I know this is a side tangent, but my wife, we buy a lot of antiques, and she bought one of those old rotary phones, and we had just gotten it, and it was sitting out on her desk when we had a party that evening. And then at some point in the party, one of the adults was like, hey, shh, look at this, and pointed over. And we all looked over, and all the kids were surrounding the phone, and they were poking it, and they were picking it up, looking at it upside down, like it was a alien technology. It was hilarious. They couldn't figure it out. It was plugged in, too. It worked.
Do you know how infuriating that rotary phone was as a kid? Like trying to, like, I remember getting on that thing, time to call grandma. We'd pick up that phone and you accidentally right. don't carry your finger all the way over. You have to hang up, start all over.
That's yeah. right. But that's what that Chris Rock bit in Lethal Weapon 4 about the rotary phone. That's it right there. That's the exact experience.
Okay, guys at home, we're going to include that bit for you here. So you guys can hear what a rotary phone you're dealing with.
That's right.
Hello? Hello? Shit! F***ing phones, man. You get a call, they cut you off. You make a call, they cut you off. What's the point?
Don't you know what they're doing, kid? They f*** you with cell phones. That's what it is. They're f***ing you with the cell phone. They love when you get cut off. You know why? Huh? You know why? Because when you call back, which they know you're going to do, they charge you for that f***ing first minute again at that high rate.
If you're lucky enough to be able to call back, because the 3-hour battery you got only lasts for 20 minutes.
Or what if you're behind a fucking hill and it's going,
you're going through a damn tunnel or some shit, man? And they keep making it smaller. You know why they make them this small? So you can lose them. Why? So you have to buy more phones. I never lost my mother's phone. Took you 2 hours to make a damn long distance call. 4. 5. Oh, I messed up. Hang up. Gotta do it again. 4. 5. I never lost my Sports Illustrated swimsuit phone.
And how about the fucking scanners?
All right, next up, we have Madeline McGraw as Gwen. McGraw was also cast immediately as Tim's co-lead for the film. She has 27 acting credits.
Yeah, big time.
And is best known as McKenna in American Sniper, which, if you don't remember, that was Bradley Cooper's daughter. Amber Barnes in the Cinemax original Outcast, and as Young Hope in Ant-Man and the Wasp. She currently has 2 credits in production, including a completed film titled The Harbinger, a horror mystery thriller where she plays the creepy kid. The synopsis is, when a family moves their troubled daughter to a small town and their neighbors start mysteriously dying, they fear something evil has followed them. So to get you guys in the mood for her next film, here's a trailer for the upcoming film.
I felt her evil the second she got out of that car.
Rosalie exhibits signs of psychopathy.
He could have been killed, honey.
He wasn't.
Are you saying she's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
Cursed. She's just a little lost.
All the bad stuff started happening when you guys got here.
How does an 80-year-old woman get up in a tree like that?
The Harbinger has come.
The Harbinger is a traveler doomed to hell unless he does the devil's bidding.
We all end up the same way.
She is a sweet child.
Cursed! There has to be another way!
It's dark as a black hole.
The Dark Lord.
The devil has my daughter.
He's been summoned.
I can see him burning in hell.
And he has forced me to do something terrible in order to get her back.
There is no prayer.
It's pure evil.
Or chant. Or song. That can save your daughter.
Well, okay, that actually looks pretty interesting. It's promising.
Yeah, I mean, I've often felt like these creepy kid horror movies seem to be getting a lot of traction. You know, you've got The Orphan and
Good Son.
Oh my God, The Good Son. Oh, that you dive deep into there. It was like 1998.
McCulkin went rogue on us in that one. It was like, ooh, bad McCulkin.
Yeah. So anyway, creepy kids. Yeah, I'll watch it. Sure. Why not? So McGraw is a tremendous actress, and we will get into her apex of this movie, when we get into her scene. But she brings a level of heart and realism to her character that we don't often get with child actors. I personally am predicting big things for her as she continues to build on what we saw in this movie. Gwen as a character is a strong young girl that relies on her big brother for comfort even when she doesn't necessarily need him. Highly protective, she has no problem jumping in on those who would pick on her brother. When she's sad, it's her brother she looks to for comfort.
So first, the two, I'm going to go with the two actors together, right? Because these kid actors are amazing. But this McGraw, I mean, if you ever watched her in any of her other things, and then to put her in this movie, because like we said, with her co-star, it's kind of like you got to go through all the ranges of emotions. And she had to do that in here and lay it all out there for us to see. And it is very compelling. Then you get the two of them together. So I can see why they saw these kids and they were just like, you got the part. Like, I'm not even going to look at anybody else. Makes perfect sense to me because I can't picture another, you know, you put somebody else in as Gwen. It doesn't work. The stuff that she did in this movie, it brings life to that character. And that brings life to the main star of this show.
The range is incredible on her. Like, I mean, she runs the gamut in this movie. She, you know, she cries, she's sad, she's angry, she's happy, she's laughing. Like, she runs the entire gamut of emotions and she does it convincingly to the point where you don't believe she's anybody else but Gwen.
Very much so. It kind of baffles me, like, how these young children are able to just, we talk about acting chops, and this is like, at this age, this is what you can do. What in the heck are you going to do when you're an adult?
Yeah, it's scary, right?
Yeah.
She's got Meryl Streep written in her. Here we go. Yeah. And that's good because we need a new Meryl Streep because Meryl's not going to be around forever.
That's right. That's right. We need fresh blood in this industry.
All right. So moving on from McGraw, we have Ethan Hawke as the Grabber. So Derrickson wanted Ethan Hawke for the role of the Grabber from the very beginning. Hawke, who also starred in Derrickson's 2012 horror film Sinister, which we talked about earlier, has a very distinctive voice, according to Derrickson. Derrickson wanted someone whose voice could penetrate the mask and felt Hawke was the man for the job. Hawke himself wasn't so sure he wanted to play a villain, something he had never done before. However, once Hawke saw the sketches for the masks, he immediately jumped on board saying, quote, these are so scary and they're so affected, which is great because I can let the mask do the mask's work, end quote. Hawke is a tremendously gifted actor that elevates everything he is in. His ability to emote through the mask and truly make the Grabber more menacing is why he is one of the most revered actors today. Hawke himself has 96 credits. Good Lord, 96. And is best known for Training Day, the Before trilogy, Assault on Precinct 13, my personal favorite, and the recent Magnificent Seven. He currently has 7 acting credits in production.
Not at all surprising.
And while we don't know much about his character, the Grabber, we do know that he is a sick and demented dude. His masks are worn out of the shame and guilt he feels over his sickness, and he plays games with the boys he takes, forcing them to act, quote unquote, naughty so that he can justify beating them.
Yeah, it's pretty sick. But Ethan Hawke, have we had him on this before?
I feel like he's been on a show before. I feel like we've talked about him before because I remember talking about Assault on Precinct 13, but I don't remember what movie we saw.
I think you're right. We did have him on it before because I had said my favorite Ethan Hawke was Gattaca.
Yeah, that's right. Sci-fi movie.
Yeah. So yeah, he's a tremendous actor, very recognizable actor, right? You can't mistake him for anybody else. I don't know about the voice thing, though. I never thought to myself he had a distinctive voice. I'll admit that him in this movie, as far as penetrating the mask, is absolutely true. And the masks are in itself, I like what he said about letting the masks do the work. It's kind of interesting that he would give the mask credit.
I mean, the mask in itself kind of a character in this movie. I mean, that mask is very menacing and very recognizable and probably one of the funnest things about this movie. But I'll tell you that I feel like Derrickson might have a little bit of a Hawke crush. Yeah, in the same interview, he talked about why isn't Hawke getting more, you know, voice acting roles? Why hasn't Pixar called him to be in the next Disney movie? Like, he just seems to be very infatuated with Hawke as an actor. And I get it. He has a very recognizable voice. I can tell you that as soon as I heard him speak in the movie, I immediately know that that's Ethan Hawke, even though he's wearing a mask. So, I mean, he's got a recognizable voice, but I agree with you. I don't necessarily know if there's anything special about his voice.
Yeah, I guess. But I would be okay with, I mean, it is kind of baffling, right? Why hasn't he had any big voice acting gigs?
Probably because he hasn't sought any out.
Yeah, and that could be true too. Hawk is very picky about roles that he takes on. He is an actor's actor, right? He's looking for certain things to fill his experience levels. It's not, he doesn't take a role just to take a role. It's not like they're paying me a lot of money, I'll take it. For this movie in particular, yes, he didn't want to be the villain, but then he acknowledged that he hadn't really played a hardened villain. They said that there were two, he played two villains, one in Moon Knight and one in Valerian Planet, 1000 Planets movie,
oh,
whatever
my
that was.
Goodness, I don't even remember that movie, but I remember.
Yeah, he was like a pimp or something. But those weren't really villains to me, right? Because there's a little bit of redemption in both of those characters. And I think that's what drew him to this character. This character is a true villain's villain. And he has never done that before. So he acknowledged that it was a challenge. And while he doesn't want to be remembered as a true villain, he did say he's past 50. This might not be a bad way to go.
Yeah. And honestly, he plays the kind of villain that I can get behind. And that is a villain with no redemption, like you had said before.
Yeah.
He's just evil. And I don't need to know why he's evil. And I don't need to feel sorry for his backstory. And we don't need a Joker-like story to enhance his character.
Yeah.
All I need to know, he's a bad, bad dude. And his character, the Grabber, I think was based on several serial killers. It's like Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, all these major serial killers.
The writing for the show, right? And that's what they did, right? They just hodgepodged all these other real victims and real serial killers and kind of put those in. And that's what you do. You draw from real life and you insert them into your story to, again, boost that authenticity level in what we see. Because when we see these things, when we see these characteristics, i.e., drugging and throwing in a car, Ted Bundy, right? Yep. Stuff like that. We recognize what that is and we can relate to those things. So it's a good work if they're going to do that on purpose. That's fantastic because we need it. That's what's going to help me draw into this movie and accept the things I'm seeing. And I don't know if we were going to mention it, but Lee was supposed to be on this show and she did have something to say about the Ethan Hawke character.
So one of the things Lee asked was, what about the backstory for this bad guy? She really wanted to know what experiences he had had with that black phone and what his main problem was, like what brought him to this point in his life. And this is where Lee and I differ, because I don't want to know those things, because if I know those things, there's a possibility I might feel bad for this dude. And so I'd rather just be like, nah, he kills kids. He's a bad, bad man. And that's all I need to know. But Del, you're my character guy. You're deep into character. How do you feel about it?
So you would think that I'd definitely be on board with where Lee is going with this. And I do get what Lee's saying. So Lee, I get it. I understand where you're going with that. But actually for this movie and the way they wrote this movie, I don't need to know. I don't need to know why he is the way he is. I don't need to know who made him that way or where all these little quirks come from. I just don't need to know. The movie is so well written that I can accept the character that I see on screen. And I love that. I love that. So very contrast to the way that most people think I would go with this character. It was written that well that I can accept what I see on screen.
Sort of like a Darth Vader, right? I know we got a prequel of movies that explain why he was who he was. But to us kids, when we watched the original trilogy, we didn't need to know how bad.
Yeah. He was bad. That's what we needed to know. He was bad.
Bad man. Bad man.
And you're a very bad man. What was that? Seinfeld?
That's right. Seinfeld. Babu.
Yeah. Babu.
Very bad. Very bad man.
Very bad man. That's right. So what I will acknowledge, though, is if this character does become cult classic, which I'm pretty certain he is already, at some point in time, in order to make more money on this character, you're going to have to do a prequel. So she might get that in the future.
Which makes me sad because
it does.
This
takes away from the film. Yeah.
This was a fun original movie. Don't.
But it killed in the box office. And if we know how filmmaking works, they're already talking about a sequel or prequel.
You know what killed in the box office? Joe Hill. Go grab another one of his stories and let's make another movie. Yeah, you know what I mean?
So I will acknowledge that Blumhouse, who's the producers behind this movie, they don't typically dip into the same well twice. So hopefully that stays.
Yeah. That would be nice. what was that thing on Amazon Prime that you watched last year? It was like this Blumhouse horror.
Oh,
like,
my goodness. They had, yeah, they had a series of them. There was like
four, six movies.
Yeah. Yeah. It was good. It was really good. Very original. Each one completely different from the other. And in most cases, you know, no tropes. They kind of skipped the tropes. They took chances. Not all of, you know, three of them weren't that good, but I appreciate the originality and not jumping back into the same well, like, you know, Scream 5 or anything like that. Halloween 46 and whatnot.
Yeah, I like that. I like the fact that they keep it original. And I hope you're right, man. I really do. And for people at home that don't know, like I said before, Dell's a big horror fan. And with the horror movies, Dell will oftentimes text me as he watches these things, telling me how good they are. So, he'll, you know, the reason why this podcast got started is because we were recommending movies to each other. And we just talked and stuff like that. Yeah. And this is still true to this day, even though we do this podcast.
So if you're looking at our Friday article and you see horror movies, probably 99% of the time it's me.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I don't know what it is, man. I'm willing to take chances on horror movies. I'm always willing to take chances on those films. And, you know, I honestly, after seeing Ethan Hawke in this one, I did like him in Sinister. I did like him in Sinister. I'll take Ethan Hawke in a horror movie any day of the week.
He was in the first Purge, wasn't he? Yeah, Ethan Hawke, the Purge.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah, there it is. I don't consider the Purge horror movies, though. They're like thrillers.
Okay, moving on.
Yeah, they're not horror movies. There's nothing scary about them.
They're horror movies. Very gory.
You can see who's the horror guy on this show. What is your favorite Ethan Hawke role?
Assault on Precinct 13.
We did have this conversation before. He has been on this podcast.
Yeah, because that's a character I wanted him to reprise. I felt like, after that character gets his redemption in the end and he decides he's going to be a cop again, I want the next installment.
You wanted to dip back into the well for that one.
Yeah, I did. Yep.
All right.
But the horror movies get ridiculous. I mean, the Grabber in space. You know, I mean, that's where this thing goes eventually.
Oh, no. The Grabber versus Jason versus Freddy, right?
Yeah.
Versus Michael.
Yeah. See, I don't
want
that.
That's what we need.
Yeah.
We need that versus Sam Haines versus Jeepers Creepers
and the Candyman.
And again, man.
All right, Dell, let's get into scenes.
We haven't done scenes in a while, Kenny.
Yes, I know, because we've been doing a lot of anniversary films.
This is good. I'm looking forward to this. What do you got?
All right. So I have what I call my dreams are just dreams. So for me, one of the most intense scenes in the movie comes from inside the home as we get an inside look at Gwen and Finney's life. After falling asleep on the couch watching TV the night before, Finney is awakened in the morning by screams from his sister coming from the kitchen. After running to investigate, Finney sees Gwen getting beat with a belt by their alcoholic father, who is clearly drunk. Their father is mad because the police came to talk to him at his work regarding Gwen's visions.
They came to my work. Why did the police come to my work?
Sorry.
You need to tell me what you know about this investigation.
Nothing.
Tell me what. What?
Nothing.
Huh?
Nothing.
What?
Nothing. Hit me again and I'm dropping it.
You drop that and I will beat your ass twice as hard. Oh, now you listen to me. Listen to me. You are not your mother.
I know.
That means you do not hear things that are not there. You do not see things that are not there.
Okay.
They're not there, Gwenny.
Okay.
And your dreams, they're just f***ing dreams. Do you understand me?
Yes.
Do you understand me?
Yes.
Say it. I want to hear you say it.
My dreams are just dreams.
Say it again.
My dreams are just dreams.
Say it again.
My dreams are just dreams.
Go watch some television. And no ice on that bottom, young lady. I want you to think about what you did. Did you know anything about this? You got that? I get out.
So, Del, this is a truly heart-wrenching, heart-wrenching scene to watch, as Madeline McGraw really does an incredible job. You really feel everything she is feeling and get lost in this scene. She moves from anger to fear, oftentimes making the decision to stand up for herself, even at her own expense. This film grapples with bullying from many angles, but mostly it discusses the importance of standing up for yourself. When we see Finney in this scene, we can immediately see the differences between Gwyn and him. Gwyn isn't afraid like Finney is, as she is threatening to drop his bottle and even saying, "My dreams are just dreams," through gritted teeth. Even in a moment like this, when Finney wants to rush to his sister's rescue, fear holds him at bay. And I can tell you, since I too have felt the wrath of the belt, not from an alcoholic father, of course, you always get it twice as bad if you fight back. So I understand Finney's reluctance here, but there's a piece, though, a piece of me that wants him to rush in there and take the brunt of the hits for his sister.
Yeah, no peace for me, man. All of it. I'm yelling at my TV. I'm like, get in there. Help her. What the hell is wrong with you? You know, it's a powerful, powerful scene. I have no doubts that this is taken directly from the page of Derrickson. And you know, this is, if this was a translation from some time in his life where he put that on paper, what a very powerful scene. It's emotional. It's charged. It makes me just want to get into that kitchen and get involved in that situation while pointing the finger at Finney and saying, get in it. You know, wake up, kid. Fight back. Do something. And that's the point, right? You see the strength of the sister, the failure of the father, and the weakness of the son. It's a very powerful scene, and it's a perfect setup at the perfect time in the film that kind of gives you what you need to know going forward.
Agreed. And that was wonderfully put. I don't think I could put it any more eloquently than you just did. You nailed it. So the only thing I would want to add, and the only thing I would want to ask regarding this scene is, do you think that this scene is powerful enough to nab an Oscar nom for Madeline McGraw?
So we both know this will never get considered, right? We know that.
The film won't, but she could.
You think so?
We've seen, you know, odd roles get the traditional pick here and there where they do something amazing in the movie, even if the movie stinks. I mean, hell, Joker, right? From Heath Ledger got it for The Dark Knight, even though it was posthumously.
That's a good point. So do I think that she's worthy of being nominated? Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, her performance in this film. So as the Tim's being the lead, I don't know if that helped to motivate him to try harder on set, or it was a challenge, or what it was, or he learned from her. But you can tell who was driving the acting in this movie. I mean, she does deserve a nom, especially for that scene alone. But there's a couple other scenes in this film that, you know, she's showing the range.
Agreed. Yeah.
Like I said, she is that complimentary character that without her specifically, right, McGraw specifically, in this role, the film just isn't as good.
Yeah, and I could see that. But there's a part of me that really hopes she gets a nom for this, because I agree with you 100%. I think she makes the movie, and without her, the movie isn't the same, like you said. Yeah. So I'd like to see that nomination come through.
Yeah, I don't think, unfortunately, I just don't think it's going to happen. You know who's pretty good at predicting this stuff? Predict Flicks, our friend from Instagram and TikTok.
I follow him on TikTok.
Yeah, maybe I'll throw it at him, see what he thinks. But he is pretty damn close when he does his predictions.
Wow. All right, Del, moving on. This is going to totally surprise you, but I got Tech.
Oh, wow. That's been a while. It's been a while for Tech.
Been a while, long, long while for Kenny to have Tech. I think Ghostbusters was the last time Kenny had Tech.
We had an opportunity for Tech in Jerry and Marge Go Large.
Oh, yeah. 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 Carrying the boxes of tickets or something.
Yeah, that's right. Well, hey, you got me sold. What do you got?
All right. So I've got The Making of the Mask. For the development of the iconic mask of the Grabber featured in the film, Derrickson turned to legendary makeup artist Tom Savini. Savini, whose legendary credits include films like 1980's Friday the 13th, 1982's Creepshow, and 1985's Day of the Dead. Of course, I personally love him as an actor, as he played Sex Machine from Dusk Till Dawn, which, if you remember that movie, I loved him as that character.
No, you love the this pistol is what you like.
That was cool. That was cool. That's right. All right. So it took inspiration from the horror-themed safety masks his company, Colossum Studios, made during COVID. The only reference Derrickson gave Savini was that he wanted the smile of the mask to look like the Man Who Laughs. For those who don't know, The Man Who Laughs is a 1928 horror drama film that featured Conrad Veidt as the horrifying, disfigured man who was surgically deformed with a grotesque, hideous smile. If you've ever seen this movie, it's still pretty scary, even by today's standards.
Agreed.
Savini came back with a sketch pretty quickly that resembles the one that's featured in the movie. And one of the biggest things that Derrickson wanted was the ability to see Ethan's eyes no matter what. Mm. Derrickson rationalized this by saying, if you can't see Ethan's eyes and he can't give his performance through his eyes, then why are we hiring someone like Ethan Hawke? And that's why the eyes are so wide on the mask in the movie. Following the final approval, Savini's collaborator Jason Baker traveled to New York to cast a mold of Hawke's face and later returned to what he was quoted as saying, a very unnerving test fitting. According to an article in Entertainment Weekly, which we will link in the podcast show notes, he is quoted as saying, we took all the masks to Ethan's office to make sure everything fitted and he was comfortable, says Baker. Ethan is so sweet and accommodating. I show up and Ethan's got like a soy latte and a vegan muffin for me. And then he puts the masks on. All of a sudden, things start to click and you can see the gears start to turn. And I'm like, I know I made this, but I don't like it and I want to leave. Broad daylight, and he's doing little maneuvers and whispering and talking. And I was like, this is terrifying.
Nice. Nice. Oh, well, it just means you got the right guy for the job.
Right? That's what I'm saying.
And it is creepy as hell. I did like that with each mask was meant to expose a different part of his face. So I don't know if you realize that.
Yeah,
so he never shows his whole face at one time. There's always pieces of his face, but never his whole face. So I thought that was interesting. And then I'll put a capper on that creepiness factor. When Derrickson sent Hawke the script and asked him if he wanted to be involved in the film, Hawke answered by leaving him a message as the grabber.
Oh, that is creepy as hell.
And not accepting, not like, hey, I'm going to accept the role. It was as the grabber.
Oh, do we have that? Do we have that?
I was desperately searching for it, but I don't think Derrickson made that public.
Oh, that would be such a cool PS scene to have on there.
Yeah, that's right. Derrickson said, he heard the message and he was excited to hear the sound, right? Like, this is what he's been thinking. But at the same time, he was like, oh, well, I guess that means he's in.
You know, one of the things I wanted to go look, and I did this while I was prepping for this show, is I went on Amazon.com just to see if you could buy this mask for, say, I don't know, Halloween or to scare the hell out of little kids. So they have it. It's $40.
Oh,
you
no can way. Buy really?
It. Yeah. Yeah. And for those interested, I'll link it in the podcast show notes.
Can you wear the hat with that mask or no?
So the mask they're selling is sort of like this rubber, like, it's foldable. Like, it's
okay.
And the mask in the movie seems like a solid shape. So I don't think it's going to have the desired effect that the one in the movie has, but I mean, it's there. So if you want to wear it.
Hey, I mean, it's a simple one, right? It's just clothes and a mask. I mean, you can do that.
If you got to take the kids trick or treating, might be fun just to wear the mask and walk around.
You got to channel that inner Ethan Hawke. That's what you got to do. You gotta channel that Ethan Hawke. That's pretty cool, though, man. I wonder, you know, I couldn't find it, but I wanted to know how much they spent. How much did they spend on these masks? How many masks? Because you know me, Kenny. I'm that guy, right? How many masks did they make? How much did they spend on it? And where are they?
Oh. Well, I would imagine there has to be several versions, but
I would imagine they made a bunch.
Would be nice to have for our museum.
That's right.
All right, Del, we're there. It's time to 3-peat this bad boy up. Since it's not your show, you go first.
All right. Well, you know, I was enjoying the ride, man. This is a good discussion about a good movie, so I was enjoying it. But all things come to an end, so here's my 3-P. Using Joe Hill's short story as source material sounds like an automatic win, but we've learned from film adaptations of his father's works that this isn't always the case. If I were to compare the two authors, I would say that The Black Phone is more like King's earlier film adaptations like Christine, The Shining, and Carrie, in that the story is solid, the acting superb, and photography, especially as a period piece, is done very well. Having said that, Scott Derrickson did a fantastic job with this movie, building up tension in 70s small-town America without going overboard on jump scares or gore, and instead focusing on the story and allowing us to involve ourselves with every aspect of the film. If I had one gripe, it would be that the emotional link between the captive brother and the psychic sister had been made much stronger, allowing us to feel her desperation to save her brother and his desire to stay alive by any means. Doing so would have added another 10 minutes or so to the film, but I would have been okay with that. However, I think Derrickson's greatest achievement with this film is that the villain Grabber, played masterfully by Ethan Hawke, is compelling enough without the need for backstory and allowing for the purest form of evil without redemption or sympathy. It's been a long time since we've had a villain like this, and I can't be thankful enough. At age 52, Hawke didn't want to be remembered for portraying a villain, but has acknowledged the challenge of being a memorable one. Some consider this his third villain role, but I'm going to discount the first two because when I think of a villain, Hawke's portrayal of the remorseless serial killer Grabber is an instant cult classic and destined to join the ranks of horror's greatest villains. The cast and crew are amazing, and it is evident that when everyone believes in a project and puts their best foot forward, we, the audience, only need to watch and enjoy. I'm giving The Black Phone a play. This isn't a great horror movie. This is a great movie, period. And I think everyone should add it to their watch list.
I like it. I like it. A play from Dell.
That's right. That's big time.
Means a winner. All right, Dell, so here I go. The Black Phone is a creepy thriller with a supernatural twist that reminds us why King's early work was so influential to our childhood. See, we hit the same theme there. We just said it differently, which I think is kind of cool. Like his father, King, Hill takes a story that features kids battling evil, just like in the movie It, but twists it because the kids are dead. Add some psychic abilities from Finney's sister Gwen, and we have a film that resonates with fantasy and horror fans. One of the lasting messages in this film is empowering victims of abuse and violence. I found a review on Screen Rant that resonated with me about this film. The quote from Screen Rant's Ray Ekman was, quote, "The Black Phone has a message of community and how terror can be warded off by the strength of numbers. No evil is so big that it can't be dispelled by the unity of individuals. The Black Phone speaks to a need that humanity has to destroy evil, even if that means reaching back from the grave to do it," end quote. This speaks to the very core of how I like to look at humanity, and that is, we are stronger together. I often have talked at length about why I love the Roland Emmerich style of disaster films, and it is all because humanity bands together when things are at their worst. The other themes of this film that resonate with my inner child are standing up for oneself and confronting bullies, something I had to do quite a bit as a kid. So for this movie, it is a play for me, and it is one of my top five movies of the year. I recommend it for anyone that loves the supernatural, kids battling evil, and honestly, the unintended 70s nostalgia while watching the film.
That's really good, man. I love that quote. I can see why you added it. But top five of the year, huh?
Yeah, it's in my top five. I'm not sure where it lands in my top five, but it's in my top five right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like the little nod to the nostalgia because it's nostalgia, but it's not so much that we need to know.
Yeah, and I think Derrickson would be offended that I like the nostalgia of the 70s because he went out of his way to try and keep from going down that road. But
then he
just can't
help
it. The rotary phone, the clothes, the bikes, the setting,
the fact that a kid can be out on a bike in the middle of the night riding around town and nobody's looking for her, right?
That's right.
Yeah. I don't think people do that nowadays.
No. Probably get in trouble from like the law. There's probably some law now we don't know about.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, Dell, this is one of those movies that sneaks into the weekend lineup and can only succeed through the word of mouth. I looked online and there wasn't much fanfare surrounding the film, with the usual movie review folks leaving it behind. Last year we loved Old Henry as a sleeper hit that was far underappreciated, and so for this year it seems The Black Phone takes the sleeper mantle.
Oh, that's a great comparison, man. Yeah, that's right. Because, you know, we took a chance on watching Old Henry and it was just such a phenomenal film. It was late in 2021. It was a surprise, but it was a welcome surprise. It was simple. It was memorable and it was enjoyable. And yeah, I feel for 2022, I feel the same way about The Black Phone. Yes, it's a horror movie. I got that, folks. But it, you know, it left me feeling good as far as enjoying a film. That I know it did well in the box office, Kenny, but I hope that this lasts longer than just the box office success. I hope it lives on online.
I agree. I hope it lives online too. And I think when this thing hits Peacock or Netflix like that, I think you're going to see a huge spike in numbers because Old Henry did pretty well on stream.
Yeah, hopefully Netflix. Old Henry didn't make it to Netflix, which is disappointing. So if the Black Phone makes it there, that'd be awesome. But Blumhouse, I think they go to Amazon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Prime has the numbers, especially now with MGM purchase. So.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. That's true. Well, I'm hoping anyway.
So, Del, I think it goes without question. We got to ask one more question before we leave, and that is, what do we want for the museum? And I think it's pretty obvious. I think we both want the mask.
I do not. If it's for the museum, Kenny, I want the phone.
Oh, that's a good pick, man. I did not anticipate that.
I love the mask. Don't get me wrong. I love the mask. But if it's for the museum, I want the phone.
Oh, great pick. Didn't see it coming. But yeah, I'm going to stick with the mask, but I like the phone pick. That's a good pick.
Yeah, imagine that. You know, people are walking through. You see the phone behind a display case, and then we'll have like another phone on a handle outside the display case. You pick it up and it'll have one of the kids' voices on the other end. It'd be super cool.
What if it, while you pass it, while it's in the glass case, it just rings periodically throughout the day for no reason?
And then you pick up the handle that sits outside.
You can't pick it up. It's behind glass.
No, but I'm saying we'll have a handle outside the glass when you pick it up. It rings, you pick it up, and the kid's talking to you. That'd be kind of creepy, man.
That would be creepy.
See, that's why I want the phone.
All right, Del, well, we've been having a blast with this one. It was definitely fun to see that both of us gave it a play. It was a Hall of Famer. If we had Arnez on board to give this a play, we could have stricken the big boy.
He would have given it a play. I know he would have.
But like in all things, they come to an end. And so we've got to wrap this bad boy up. Thanks for listening. For myself
and Del,
this has been the Brothers in Armchairs podcast. Goodbye, everybody.
Aloha.
In 1978, a serial child abductor known as the Grabbler. The Grabbler.
The Grabbler.
The Grabbler. It sounds like the dude from McDonald's. What was his name?
I was just about to say the Hamburglar. I was just about to say
rubble,
that.
Rubble,
rubble. Holy crap, he did say that, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
And watch these 1987 ads, man.
Oh, they get prepping for the show. That's right. That's right. Yeah, so you're going to be stuck in 1987. What's going to be crazy is like from now until we release that show, you're going to be using all these things and people are going to be like, what is it with Kenny and all these like 80s things?
Like, 80,
what's going on in his head?
All right.